You're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com, bringing you the freshest radio in Brooklyn since 2009. Hear directly from chefs to farmers, artists to architects, authors to brewers, and everyone in between. Check out all of our shows on our website or by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. On behalf of everybody at HeritageRadioNetwork.com, we'd like to send a special thank you to the Hearst Ranch, our biggest supporter and longest-running sponsor since we first started in 2009. Hearst Ranch is the nation's largest single-source supplier of free-range, all-natural, grass-fed, and grass-finished beef. Since 1865, the Hearst family has raised cattle on the rich, sustainable native grasslands of the Central California coast. The result is beef with extraordinary flavor that's as memorable and natural as the surrounding landscape. For more information, visit www.hearstranch.com.
All right, you're listening to Let's Eat In on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway, and this is at Roberta's Pizza on a sweltering hot Monday in July. I'm very excited today because our guests are really instrumental in this whole wonderful food scene that we've seen erupt in Brooklyn. Seriously, I mean that in a big way. And they're here today, both of them. This is the husband and wife team who started the Brooklyn Kitchen 6 years ago?
Five years ago.
Harry and Taylor.
Hi.
Hey, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah.
So you guys were just talking a little bit about how the business has changed your food or eating habits a little bit. And I just love the saying that you just said, Taylor, about how a lot of the food you make is borderline
We have been thinking a lot about the food we make at home and how it's influenced our life and how our life has influenced the food that we make at home. Kathy was just saying that we must have cooked very differently before we had access to as many ingredients. And I, thinking about that, I think that we actually tend to cook with less ingredients now because we, owning a grocery store and you know, with a butcher shop involved, we tend to take home and cook items that are no longer saleable or, you know, that somebody else would not want to pick up.
Was that contrary to your original plan?
I think it's very, you know, our home kitchen is filled with items that are slightly dented and slightly broken or discontinued, with a couple of treasures thrown in, of course, but we tend to be, you know, populated. Our kitchen tends to be populated by the things that are no longer viable in a retail front.
And moldy beef. No, just kidding.
You know, I mean, a lot of the time it'll be, you know, last night, for instance, you know, we had kind of a mishmash of stuff, and it wasn't because it was going bad, but, you know, there was one sausage left of one variety. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in the butcher case, it doesn't look good to have a single link sitting there.
Yeah.
And so I took that home, and there were, you know, there was one piece of marinated beef heart left that hadn't sold over the weekend. And again, you know, it's unlikely that a customer is going to come in today and say, oh, I want that one sausage, or I want that one link, or, you know,
marinated beef heart.
Yeah. Yeah. Or I want that one tomato that, you know, didn't get purchased because it looks a little bit, you know, it has a spot on it or something, you know, different from all the other tomatoes. And so we end up taking home, you know, I also like to call them the lonely foods.
We get the lonely foods, the ugly foods. Give us your tired tomatoes.
Sounds like fun to me. Iron Chef.
It is. It's really, that's the current challenge in our lives, is both dealing with cooking foods that just kind of, we happen to remember to grab at 6:15 as we need to leave the store. And also cooking foods that our toddler will eat, which, before you have kids, you kind of have this vision of, oh, parents can be so weird. Parents can be so weird about their kids not eating stuff. Why don't they just feed them whatever you're eating, which is so not possible in the real world with a real toddler, because they have personalities that they're developing, and those personalities sometimes and often involve what the food that they won't eat or the ways that they'll protest. They're like the ways that they define themselves by protesting against their parents, and it often manifests in what they won't choose to eat that day.
Yeah, and there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to it at all. I mean, one day, you know, rice, no problem. She'll eat as much rice as we could possibly shove in her face. Mm. The next day, same rice, same ingredients, same taste. No way. Not a chance.
Wow. That makes me really want to have kids.
inspiring.
So, well, first of all, congrats to you and cooking, because I know you guys are really busy. But how else has the business changed, as well as yourselves, in the last 5 years?
So a little more information about the Brooklyn Kitchen. We started in November of 2006. I'm like, it was November of 2006. It seems like only yesterday and a lifetime ago. And one of our first profile pieces was by Miss Kathy Irway.
I think I was one of the first people to walk into the door.
Mm-hmm. And we I think a little bit before that too. Harry and I had met in 2002. Mm-hmm. And at the time, you know, we were both living the freewheeling single life of Brooklyn 20-something.
Oh, yeah.
You may remember it. You may remember those days.
I don't know.
You know, and we kind of both lived on our own and had our own kind of cooking
schedules.
Ways. Like our own cooking, you know, we developed our own, you know, kind of life in the kitchen on our own. And then, you know, we met and we fell in love and we got married and we started developing our own cooking life together, you know, cooking food at home that was, as I remember it now, it was so much more epic. Everything that we made was like an enormous production.
Uh-oh.
You know, Harry's first foray into charcuterie was
Well, there were the dried sausages.
The dried sausages.
That were an early foray, actually, in partnership with Mr. Tom Mylan, who's now the head butcher at the Meat Hook, which is inside the butcher shop inside the Brooklyn Kitchen. You know, we were making dried sausages, and, you know, we were standing around in the kitchen and drinking a lot of bourbon and, you know, putting, you know, ground meat into casings using a KitchenAid mixer. And then, you know, we hung them for, I don't know, 5 or 6 months.
Wow.
And let them dry out a little too, you know, they dried out too far. But I mean, you know, it definitely worked. I mean, we were, you know, messing around with that. I mean, there was a, you know, mole that Taylor made.
Yes, I was thinking of the mole. Exactly, the mole, which is like...
Took 3.5 or 4 days to make.
It was a three-day project. It was a long... We always made chili for New Year's Day. Because there's, you know, when you get to a certain point in your life, you realize that New Year's Eve is... for crazy people and you know,
not for eating, drinking.
Not for eating, drinking, and like not worth paying attention to, because it's like,
because you're just gonna throw it up.
It's those high pressure holidays where it's like, what are you doing on this particular Thursday that happens to be a special Thursday, which is, you know, just so artificial. The real fun is having people over on New Year's Day and comparing hangover and like getting the war stories from your friends.
Totally.
So Harry actually started this tradition of having chili on New Year's Day. I'm sure many other people do it, but Harry started doing it in 2002.
I started doing it, it was January 1st of 2003 was the very first one, I believe.
No.
But you were at the first chili party.
Right, but I hadn't... Oh, yeah, I guess you're
right. So it would have been January 1st of 2003.
Do you still hold them?
We do.
Yes.
Every year on New Year's Day, we invite people over for chili. Back then, when it was before we were actually even dating... and I was living the aforementioned life of, you know, a single 20-something in Brooklyn, I found that the cooking of chili also was good for the hangover, not just the eating of chili.
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of the impetus for starting it. And now, of course, as Taylor mentioned, it's one of those things that it's a lot more fun, I think, and it's a lot less damaging to your apartment to have your friends over after they've done all of their New Year's drinking rather than during. But it is a tradition that we, you know, we carry on to this day. We have people over for chili, and it has taken on a life of its own, as many things do, in that originally I made some chili. I asked people if they wanted to bring some cornbread and some other stuff. And now it's sort of become a contest, but not that we have promoted. Our friends now have taken it upon themselves that it's a chili contest and that they need to compete against one another on New Year's Day, which is fine with me. I don't really, you know.
Hey, yeah, it's a homegrown chili cook-off.
But, you know, when we were first living together, Taylor made this, you know, 4-day mole or something for the chili.
The mole poblano.
It was et cetera. It was like, the recipe seemed so simple, but then when you start breaking it out, you're like, oh, right, frying all these dried chilies takes 2.5 hours. Scraping them all takes soaking them is overnight, frying them and then soaking, you know, and all these steps was a lot more involved than we had originally anticipated. But luckily it was a long weekend and we had the time to get started early, and it was absolutely delicious. It was really good. But then we ate it forever. So, I mean, we just made epic, epic projects in our early days because we had the time, and this was at the time outside of our daily lives.
Yeah,
we were
totally
working
hobby.
In, Harry was first a...
Lighting designer, right?
Mm-hmm. I was a lighting designer, and I taught lighting at Columbia and, you know, spent a lot of time in the academic world.
And I was, you know, working a 9-to-5 day job at JOB. So when I would come home...
As a scientist,
home,
right?
I was construction management.
Oh,
so
okay.
I was doing construction management and project management for Stuytown. And so, you know, at 5 o'clock when the whistle blew, I would leave and I would come home and I would, you know, have, you know, be able to engage my creative side of my brain by doing some cooking and eating. So that was, it was the hobby, it was the outside of our real life lives.
But it's also a need, too.
It was, and we had to feed ourselves.
Yeah.
And then it was another chili party, Chili Party New Year's Day 2006, that we realized that the neighborhood didn't have a good place to buy good tools, good knives, good pots and pans, and canning jars, which we had spent days and months and weeks searching for the summer before. And that was, you know, the
that
light
the
bulb
thing.
Went
and this
on.
This is your neighborhood, right? Greenpoint,
yeah,
Williamsburg.
We lived in Greenpoint, but we'd lived in and around Williamsburg for the past 6 years at that point. And so it was, that's when the light bulb went off and realized that something could, that there was a market for it. So, you know, we kind of toyed with this idea.
With chili. It chili New Year's Eve
the epic
tradition.
Chili. Yeah.
That's amazing. It's so funny how things start like that.
Right.
And now, of course, if, for those who don't know, the Brooklyn Kitchen Labs is a culinary school with classes like every two a day or so. Great workspaces, very friendly, communal, dig-in, hands-on classes, and also a great butcher, the Meat Hook, which is conjoined. It's quite an experience. People come from like all over the country to check it out.
When we first, in 2009, when we first opened the Meat Hook, we had a Japanese television crew do a segment for their morning program in Tokyo.
It was live broadcast.
Of a pig butchering class. It was very funny.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So the pig butchering classes have always been this unique draw.
Yeah, right? I mean, I think that one of the things, you know, with us becoming interested in cooking and then starting the Brooklyn Kitchen because we needed somewhere to, you know, couldn't get the tools and things like that and recognized a sort of a need in the neighborhood. You know, the classes, I think, came out of the same sort of idea that it was sort of, you know, we were scheduling and programming classes about subjects that we were interested in expanding our own knowledge about in the beginning. The pig butchering class came about originally because we were interested in starting to do some kind of butchering classes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was friends at that time with Tom Island, and we were sitting around one night and I said, let's, you know, do you want to do a butchering class? Tom at the time was doing all the butchering for Diner and Marlowe. It was before Marlowe and Daughters opened. And he said, sure, you know, let's do a class about chicken and duck, and we'll do, you know, start with poultry, and then maybe we could do, you know, a lamb, and then maybe, you know, if people had enough interest, maybe we could build it up and do a half a pig. And I said, you know, let's start with a half a pig. And part of that was my own curiosity, having never at that point seen a half a pig get taken apart into its, you know, into all the cuts. And so it was my, you know, that came out of my own interest in saying, well, if I'm interested in this, I bet you there's other people.
Totally.
And, you know, the hunch turned out to be correct.
It was a ballsy move, though. I mean, people, like a whole half side of a pig, it's a shocking, it's a very visceral experience.
But it makes sense. And I think people really appreciate being able to understand where, you know, how an animal becomes a pork chop.
Yeah. Have you ever thought of doing pig slaughtering or classes?
You know, it's interesting. People have asked us about that, and we've had people say, well, you know, now I've done the butchering, I really want to learn about the slaughtering. And I say, okay, well, if you really want to learn about the slaughtering,
it's a little weird.
I can put you in touch with some farms if you really want to know about it. But I think that, you know,
you
by and large, people don't really want to know.
Yeah,
that.
That's not quite a kitchen thing, too.
Right. It's a different sort of life experience.
It's an
thing.
Agricultural.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think that people think that they want to know about it because there is a sense also, I mean, you know, the pig butchering class is education, but it also is, you know, there is an entertainment factor to it, and you get to, you know, it's an experiential thing. And I think that people have this sense that the next step in that experience that they enjoyed would be to undertake slaughtering. But I don't think people quite have a real understanding of what that means. I think, you know, people can get a good sense of it. I think there's been a lot of interesting video that's come out recently. I know Liza DeGuia, who does Food Curated, did a really, really good video about a small slaughterhouse in New York State that really, you know, shows what the realities are. Of, you know, and in that case, what the realities are of a really well-run, really clean, small slaughterhouse, not, you know, a controlled animal feeding operation or any of that kind of thing.
Totally. So thanks to these classes, a good chunk of Brooklyn has seen, you know, the whole side of the pig, the whole side of the pig, pun intended. You know what? I was just thinking, I would love to have you guys ever had a fish butchering class? Because I'm so bad at that.
I know. It's hard. I
mean, filleting is hard.
Filleting is hard. It's somewhat, I mean, it's certainly...
Maybe for the knife skills class.
Well, we've just started having knife skills, which has been our most popular class since we started having it with Brendan McDermott, who's still teaching it. We've just started offering once a month an advanced knife skills class.
Oh, cool.
And that class, the next one is on August 10th, I believe.
Right.
And that class comes with a 6-inch boning knife. And also comes with a whole chicken and a whole fish.
So that's
and
the key.
So in the course of
knife.
The class... You learn how to use the knife, you learn how to break down the chicken in different ways, and you learn how to fillet the fish, and then you get to take all the protein home.
Do you have to take the first class before you can advance this?
No,
advanced?
Not, okay. Not at all. It's not, you know, there's no prerequisite. And I think it is a great class because people, not only do you get the experience, you know, we, in that class, speaking about fish specifically, we use a flat fish. So we use a flounder or, you know, something of that
and
nature.
That's tougher, right?
Well, it's actually, the reason we do that is that on a flat fish, you basically get 4 fillets because of the shape of the fish. And so you actually get more practice at filleting than if you were filleting a round fish.
Or you get these H figure-shaped things. Okay, so I know you guys picked out a little song to jam with for a sec here.
Of course, classic.
Yeah. All right, let's put it on. We'll be right back. Kathy Irway, and I'm here with Harry Rosenblum and Taylor Erkinen from the Brooklyn Kitchen. Did I pronounce that wrong?
It's Erkinen, I guess. I mean, that's how my family pronounces it. I think it's more Finnish and Finland, like Erkinen. But we don't go there, so I'm not.
I
worried.
Tried to be enunciate. Anyway, that was a good pick. That song. Thanks.
I'm actually really sad because I thought about it last night, and I didn't dig around in my CD collection because my cousin, Michael Erkinen, covers that song on an album that I have, but I wasn't able to bring that in, that version, which I really like. But
yeah.
I like the song
classic,
anyway.
Though. Good stuff. Thanks so much for sharing the insight about the whole genesis of the Brooklyn Kitchen, and where do you see it going now?
Well, I mean, I think since 2006 when we started the store, our cooking life changed with the advent of running our own business. I mean, we were running our own business designed around and coming from cooking at home. And yet, as soon as we started, we really lost the ability to continue in that epic tradition that we had started, had come from. You know, we no longer, you know, we worked in the store every day, seven days a week for 2.5 years, you know, until we could finally take a reliable day off.
Mm-hmm.
That reliable day off is, you know, we're getting there. It always changes, and you know, it's not always reliable, but for 2.5 years, we were working in the store every day, often from 10 o'clock to 8 p.m. So we were not able to continue cooking in the same tradition and weren't even really, you know, it was very, it became very abbreviated and very foreshortened, our cooking at home.
Yeah, when we would go on, you know, the few vacations we took those first years, I think we actually did more cooking while we were on vacation because we were away and we didn't have to, you know.
At the same time, I bet you helped the neighborhood get ahead in cooking while you degress.
There's the dirty secret, because we would be talking to everybody and making recommendations about their cooking, and at the same time, shamelessly eating takeout. You know, not all the time, but still, you know, you have to make do and you have to survive. And as we, you know, we hired a couple of people, and some of them are still with us, which is great. And had more time to ourselves and didn't have to close the store overnight. Then we started to. We were no longer able to do the same kind of epic
moles.
The epic moles, but more reliable everyday cooking started to take hold in a way that it hadn't really been the case before. So, and then with a more structured strategy for bringing lunch to the store. In my working world, I never really got into that habit of bringing food in every day, and I know that that is very much part of your background, is not eating out. But so in the, I feel like the 2008 2009 years were very much about starting to have a reliable rhythm.
You made it
about like reliable rhythm about cooking at home with a little more time, and. Why did I say that we didn't do epic projects? 2008 was the year of the pig head, because when we were started doing we started doing the pig butchering classes, and the way that it worked in the original initial days was that everybody who took part in the class would go through and have, they'd have a bag, and it would be a lottery system, and it, well, not lottery, but a draft, basically.
Yeah, and we'd divide up the half a pig into, it was 12 people in the class, so we'd divide the half a pig into 12 sections, essentially. Each person got to take home a part of it, because we had nowhere to keep it. We weren't operating in a place that had a commercial refrigerator. Mm-hmm. We didn't have a walk-in, and it couldn't go back to, you know, we had ordered it sort of through Marlowe and Diner, but they didn't have room for it. They didn't want it back, and it was, you know, so we'd had to divvy it up and get it out of there. And probably 9 times out of 10, nobody would take home the head.
It's too epic for most people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we ended up taking the pig head home a bunch of times.
Yeah.
The first
sometimes
time,
every week.
Right.
The Brooklyn Kitchen head cheese. Now
It was. It was. It became. It definitely. That was. There was a very steep learning curve, but the first head cheese that Harry made, it just tasted like pig head, right? I mean, we basically boiled everything down, and it just, and didn't really add any spices
salt,
and aromatics.
We also
salt.
Didn't brine it the first time,
right? So we, and then the second time we brined it, and the third time I think was where we hit the stride, where it's like you have to cook it, dump that water, cook down the head, add an entire magnum of cheap white wine, and I think that is the secret to like bringing that flavor up, because it's so, like, it's a pig head, it's very heavy, it's very dense, it's very, it's a very low flavor profile, and so dumping an entire bottle of cheap white wine, hey Riuniti,
I find that
really
fresh herbs kind of jellied in there, chopped up,
and celery is
celery,
a nice crunch.
Oh, okay.
At the end, so we started mastering head cheese and
crazy,
and that was because we didn't, you know, I felt like we couldn't at that time, you know, we couldn't in good conscience have this event and then throw the head away.
Right.
Yeah,
it was, you know, it seemed like a good idea, and we tried to come up with other things to do with it. I think at the very end of that run, what I realized is that it was easier, and actually also then easier to freeze and use up later, to make scrapple out of the head.
That's right.
Scrapple then became, you know, we did lots of head cheese for many, many weeks, but then scrapple, I realized, was faster and easier.
Yeah.
I mean, it is really good, and it could be done in a pressure cooker, which was really the key, was that you didn't, you know, when we were doing the head cheese, you know, you have to essentially simmer the entire pig head for hours. And so what we would do is put it,
leave it overnight
in the oven. Mm-hmm. In a pot of water, the way that the way that Harold McGee recommends making stock,
right?
And you know, put it in the oven at like 225 degrees or 200 degrees, and go to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And at like 4:30 in the morning, the entire house would smell like pig head, and I would wake up and like stumble to the kitchen and turn it off and then go back to sleep so that it would be cool enough by the time, you know, the middle of the morning came that you could pick all the meat and start the next part of the process.
So fun.
Yeah, we definitely got to a rhythm with pig heads.
Yeah.
So then in 2008, I found out that I was pregnant, and Moxie was born July of 2009. Contemporary with that, the pig butchering classes and the knife skills classes and several of the other classes that we were having on a monthly basis would sell out within hours of being announced every month. So,
you know, I remember there's people just literally like standing on shelving just to like get in there. It's amazing.
12 people standing around a room not designed or in any way accommodatable of these people to watch a pig being butchered or watch kombucha being made would all happen in the tiniest room at the same time that the store was open. And it was, you know, it wasn't conducive to anybody else shopping during that happening. Yeah, and it wasn't really conducive to that happening at all. So we started to recognize that the space wasn't allowing us to do as much as we needed to do. And it was really becoming a customer service drag when people would call up and say, but I really want to take this class and I've been wanting to take it for months and I haven't been able to take it. And I was like, well, 12 other people called first this time, you know?
Right.
It sucked. So we were walking around the neighborhood looking for another space to just have classes.
Yeah.
And Harry, you want to field this one?
So we were on our way. It was in April of 2009. So Taylor was 6 months pregnant. And we were on our way walking to look at a space that was for rent, thinking that we would just move the cooking classes offsite into a garage or something. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I had already had a few conversations with, by that time, Marlowe and Daughters was open. And mm-hmm. so Tom Mylan and Brent Young and myself had a couple conversations about...
That's the butcher shop sister of Marlowe and Sons.
Exactly. And had some conversations about that, you know, about, you know, well, what if they wanted to open their own butcher shop someday? And would we, you know, have mm-hmm. room for that if we found a big enough space and, you know, all this stuff. And we were going to look at a space, and before we got to the space that was for rent, we walked past our current location, and the door was open, and the building was empty. Mm-hmm. And we walked inside, and I said to the guy standing there, is this for rent? And he said, yeah, you know, I'm putting up a sign in about 20 minutes.
Oh,
so
nice.
We were the first people to see the space when it came on the market for rent, and took one look at what is now Lab 1, which is our large lab space that has 19-foot ceilings
and, event space,
you know,
and that kind
big
of thing.
Open kitchen and skylights. And my first phone call was to our contractor, and my second phone call was to Tom, who I knew had the day off that day. And I said, I'm going to come pick you up. You got to check this place out.
Cool.
So we took a look at it, and luckily, you know, for us, the owners were willing to sort of wait and work with us while we were able to put together financing in order to do it.
Well, congratulations. You definitely did it right. What, you got some upcoming classes that are particularly cool?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in part of our process of epic, we keep going back to that, the epic cooking.
Yeah.
We would have dinner parties. One of the classes that we have coming up is taught by our friend Millicent Souris, which is the timing of a dinner party.
Ooh,
so there's a class coming up on the 25th of July that is designed to help conceive of designing the time, laying the time out for how to prepare what, when, if you're having people over for a dinner party.
Ooh, I'm supposed to do that?
I mean, it was just, you know, figuring out how to not load the oven all at 4 p.m.
I know.
You know, the day of
especially
the party.
Especially on Thanksgiving. Right? People get freaked out by that. Turkey and then pies. Ah!
Right.
Okay.
Pie, then turkey. Cook the pie the day before.
Exactly.
This will teach you. We're doing... I think one of the reasons why we started the store was because of our own personal interest in canning and preserving, because we had grapes in our backyard and our inability to find any pectin. And then since we started selling these things, everybody has been starting to relearn these traditions that have disappeared so long ago. We're doing a series of classes with Sherry Brooks Vinton, who's the author of Put 'Em Up. She's teaching canning and preserving classes.
Got a show with her in the archives.
Oh, great. Yeah. That's not just pickling. That's going to be, it's pretty much every other Wednesday. So the next class is on July 27th, and there's another couple throughout July, throughout August.
It's a perfect time for canning and jamming when everything is super awesome and ripe.
Yep.
Because you'll taste that in the winter. Yeah, and cheaper.
We, in August, appropriately, have a pile of tomato classes.
Yeah.
One thing that we did last year was we offered our customers the ability to buy
a box of
yeah. tomatoes. Yeah, canning tomatoes in bulk. So we'll be doing that again. It's a 20 or a 30-pound box. I don't remember. But those will be available again in August, and we're doing a series of classes specifically regarding tomatoes, and of course the general overview canning class will address tomatoes a little bit. It's water bath canning. The same principles do apply.
Definitely want to save that fresh tomato flavor for the winter.
I tend to save them and then treasure them and then not open them up until it's like May or June. Next tomatoes
Well, I didn't wait that long. I bought this last year, and I can't recommend it enough. It was great.
Yeah.
Put them up. A lot of jars of tomatoes. Thanks to you guys. So that's so cool. I mean, you guys are really like getting like segues into local farms, you know, the direct connection there. Great deals for the customers thanks to that.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. What else?
What else?
My favorite question.
Yeah.
That could be what else. What's the perfect date meal?
Ooh.
Sexy, romantic. I'll let you figure out what that
means.
We're
looking at each other. I don't know.
It's fun to have a couple on this show to answer.
I think a good date meal that breaks down barriers for first or early date is ramen. Because you can't be all cool when you're slurping soup. You know what I mean? Like, and it's so delicious. And it's, well, if it's good, it's delicious.
Ramen's a good one. I was going to say in the same vein, I mean, sticking with Japanese, I was going to say something like, you know, izakaya. Because it's communal. I mean,
you
have to eat together. I mean,
you have to get all these small plates.
Exactly, because you're not, you know, you aren't just ordering separate entrees.
Or it's a good test, I guess.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, be like, I'm going to get this, and, you know, let's order this.
That's
true. If she shares, you know, if he gets food all in his face, you know, these are the tests that should be evaluated for a future relationship.
Watch out, guys. Don't get food on your face. It's a kaya plate. That's a good answer. Very, very creative. You guys are still cracking up. Did that happen or something? No. Okay. Anyway, I guess we're about out of time, but thank you guys so much for being on the show. Check out thebrooklynkitchen.com, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Moby, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Hi, this is Moby, and you're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. A new film is coming out. It's called American Meat. It's a documentary based on the life of Joel Salatin of Polyface Farms. But it also includes footage from conventional livestock agriculture and processing plants. So you do get a bit more of a less biased, shall we say, view of how livestock agriculture works. It makes many of the same arguments, of course, as you would have seen in Food Inc., so there's nothing especially groundbreaking here, but in this case, the producers claim to be free of a quote-unquote agenda. If you didn't get enough information from Food Inc., look for this one. Again, it's called American Meat. The website gives no release date, but you can learn a little bit more by Googling just American Meat. This has been Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.
Finger on the Pulp and City Winery are proud to present the Summer Barbecue Blowout Festival, August 6th, from noon to 4 p.m. The barbecue is happening at City Winery, located at 155 Varick Street in New York City. Restaurants featured at this event are Empire Mayonnaise, Van Dag, Momofuku Moat Bar, Imperial No. 9, Mile End, Mexico, Kraft, Dizzy's Club, Coca-Cola, The Meatball Shop, and Dos Toros. Providing the soundtrack for the day are Midnight Magic, Pewter Magic, New Villager, Punches, Ducky, DJ Autobot, and the Snacky Tune DJ. VIP and general admission tickets are available at citywinery.com. Finger on the Pulse of City Winery, we'd like to thank our sponsors, Heritage Foods USA, New York Magazine, Reka Vodka, Sonar, Smile, Guilt City, Sub-Zero, and Wolf. Please come out and join us for a day of fun, food, and dancing. For more information, go to www.fotpnyc.com.
July 23rd, Bushwick Block Party.
Block Party.
It's a party in the street.
Free pizza by Roberta.
Death Killer Death Wrestling.
Featuring the legendary Mad Dog Tosto.
Photo Booth by Ryan Slack.
Water World.
Closed by
Chimera Dactyl.
Mary Meyer.
Warren Bogart.
Death Killer.
Asphalt Resistant Jeans.
All types of food for your face.
Sweet soda by
P&A.
Roberta's Bake Sale.
Heritage Foods USA.
Orange Chaney Eating Contest
by the Orange Chaney Brothers.
Live music by
Alex Truchin.
Florida
Paper Twin.
Dang Sign.
The Netherlands.
Team Robespierre.
Wild Yak.
MC Todd and Bo Breezy.
Night Show.
Yeah, yeah.
Sponsored by
Martin Greenfield Clothers.
Free Fitness Studio.
Heritage Radio Network.
Free Williamsburg.
6 Point Beer.
Momo's
Sushi Shack.
Beer Box USA.
Planet of the Bates.
Bushwick Block Party. It's a party in the street.
All day long.